I'm a big fan of sending robots to Mars. That's what I do for a living. But I firmly believe that the best way to explore Mars is going to be with humans. So I think moving towards human exploration of Mars is a goal that is an appropriate one for a great national space agency.
Well, that's one vote for the value of humans in the face of advancing technology. A conference this week brought a group of scientists together to talk about things geophysical. And as those people were thinking big, other scientists have been thinking small, very small. This is PodTech News Weekly Magazine for Saturday, December 16th, 2006. For Jason Lopez, I'm Paul Lancour. Microsoft last week announced it's releasing a toolkit for building robotic software, Microsoft Robotics Studio. Software for controlling robots has typically been a slow and tedious process, and Microsoft hopes to capture a new market of software developers eager for tools to make their job more efficient and creative. Robotics may be a relatively small market segment, but robots everywhere are doing jobs humans can't or shouldn't do. From drone aircraft that can fly through hurricanes to the sophisticated dune buggies roving the craters of Mars, this story is all about remote-controlled robots. And we mean really remote. PodTech's Catherine Girardeau reports.
Scientists and journalists gathered in San Francisco last week for the American Geophysical Union's annual meeting talked of many things: global warming, the real effects of a nuclear war, space weather, inflating volcanoes, and remote-controlled robots doing important and dangerous work in environments inhospitable to humans. Taking measurements inside hurricanes, for example, or exploring Mars, where the average temperature is 81 below. Let's start closer to home and then work our way past the outer atmosphere. This is PodTech News. I'm Catherine Girardeau.
The hurricane that I was through, the eye was extremely wide, about 80 miles. And you could just see this long, long curving cloud all around you. It's really beautiful.
That's Will Drennan, a professor at the University of Miami's Rosenstiel School of Marine and Atmospheric Science. Drennan is part of a team of scientists urgently trying to improve hurricane intensity forecasting. Meteorologists have gotten pretty good at predicting where a hurricane is going to go, but forecasting the strength of hurricanes and the specific kinds of havoc they will wreak has lagged behind. Will Drennan said aircraft called P-3s, operated by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, have been used for the past 30 years. He's even gone up in a few. But the newest and most important tool in predicting the intensity of hurricanes is a robot, a drone aircraft.
In the last couple of years, the most exciting thing out there now is something called an aerosonde, which is a remote-controlled aircraft, which can go places that the NOAA aircraft can't go. The first successful penetration of a hurricane was earlier this year off of Taiwan. With these new sondes, you can actually get down extremely low into the hurricane to places where it's far too dangerous for an aircraft to go.
What's kind of the technology behind an aircraft that can fly in winds of that intensity?
They look very similar to a model glider. The wingspan is, I guess, about 4 meters, about 20 feet. It's usually controlled, pre-programmed in advance, so it would fly down a step descent down quite low, and then it would also go around the hurricane and into the eye of the hurricane as well.
And what kind of information could be gathered from the eye of the hurricane that can't be gathered from the outer parts of the storm?
It's more the eye wall of the hurricane, which is the most exciting. That's where the highest winds are, the most intense turbulence, and the highest wind shears. So that's where much of the focus is right now of research. It's also the key to how hurricanes intensify. It's the processes in the eye wall, which is most important to understand, and especially low down. And that's what's the most difficult to do right now with the existing technology. It's impossible to get low down, just above the ocean, essentially. It's simply too dangerous.
Drennan has been a passenger on several NOAA P-3 flights, flying directly into hurricanes to take measurements of components like moisture content, wind speed, wind direction, and the like.
I was on a flight a couple of years ago. We got down to about 60 or 70 meters. just over 200 feet. Now, we were doing that about 200 kilometers away from the eye. And it's important to get that low because that's how you can understand exactly how the ocean and the atmosphere are talking to each other, essentially. Hurricanes extract their energy from the ocean, and it's the actual processes of the extraction which are what we're interested in. And in order really to understand that, you have to get down low. One of the big unknowns right now is sea spray. We all know that sea spray is an extremely important part of the problem, but up to now, there's no measurements at all of sea spray in hurricane conditions. So we'd certainly like to get some piece of equipment down there which can actually measure what the sea spray contributions are.
So essentially, how much of the ocean's water is getting whipped up and added to the moisture in the hurricane itself?
Right. The water is evaporated from the ocean surface, taking heat from the ocean, and then within the eye walls, it goes way up high into the hurricanes where once it is recondensed back to water vapor, it releases all that heat. And that's the energy which gets the hurricanes going. So understanding how the water is evaporated from the ocean is a very important part of the problem.
Drennan said the planned drone aircraft will carry radars to measure the structure of the surface waves and drop SONs, or GPS profilers, into the air and ocean to gather atmospheric data and measure how the ocean is changing as the hurricane passes over it. What's ahead in the race to better forecast hurricane strength before the next Katrina hits a highly populated area? The National Center for Atmospheric Research is seeking funding for a new program called Wi-Fi, which will use a fleet of 6 low-orbiting, radar-equipped satellites to take continuous measurements of atmospheric data. Let's move now out of our atmosphere and onto Mars. A team of scientists on Earth are controlling a fleet of robot vehicles that are exploring the craters, plains, and mountains of the fourth planet from the Sun. The two rovers, Spirit and Opportunity, are exploring Mars nearly 3 years into what was planned as a 3-month mission. Stephen Squires, an astronomy professor at Cornell University, leads the team of scientists who decide what these remote-controlled rovers are going to do each day. Stephen spoke on a panel about the Mars rover's latest discoveries. I asked him how the Mars rovers are powered.
The rovers are powered by the sun. They have solar panels on the upper surface of the rover that are used to generate electrical power. We use that power to drive the rovers, to take the pictures, to transmit the data back to Earth. We have batteries on board that can store that power temporarily. But we are completely dependent on the sun for our power on the surface of Mars.
And the rovers have been exploring now for 3 years?
Almost 3 years. We landed in January of 2004.
And you were expecting this to be a 3-month mission. How is it possible that it's been extended so far?
I would say that 3 months was when the warranty expired. That's the best way of putting it. We designed them to last at least that long. Why have they lasted this long? It's been a combination of factors. One is we built good rovers. You know, we're proud of that. We just built good, solid hardware that had lasted a long time. But the key things were, first of all, we've been really lucky with the weather. What we thought was going to kill these rovers was dust on those solar panels. And while dust has built up, on several occasions we've had these wonderful, lucky gusts of wind that have cleaned the solar panels off and given us a new lease on life. The other thing was that we never expected that we'd be able to, especially for the Spirit rover, which is pretty far from the equator, we never thought we'd be able to survive a Martian winter. But what we didn't reckon on was being able to drive the rover onto steep slopes. We landed these places where the terrain is pretty flat. But we've been able to drive far enough that we've been able to find craters, been able to find mountain ranges, and to drive the rover onto slopes that will tilt the solar arrays towards the sun in the wintertime. Sun gets low in the sky, but what you do is you drive the rover onto a slope that tilts it towards where the sun is, and it increases the power dramatically.
Since Squire's job is essentially to figure out where to point the remote, I asked him what kinds of things the rovers can do.
As we've been on the surface of Mars, we have, through our experience, come to realize that we'd like the rovers to be smarter than they were when we landed. Fortunately, we're able to do that. We can't send new hardware up there. We can't send somebody up with a wrench to fix something when it breaks. But the software we can improve. And so we've made a number of improvements to the software to make the rover smarter and more capable. I'll give you two examples. One you already mentioned, and that is that we can now, in a single step,
If we see a rock that's, 5 meters away that's interesting to us, we can drive the rover to that rock and command the rover to place the arm on the rock all in one day. Used to be, we'd have to drive to the rock, take a picture, send that picture down on the ground. We sit down, look at the picture, and figure out how to put the arm on the rock and then tell the rover how to do it. Now the rover's smart enough to do that on its own, and that saves time. Another example is that at the Spirit site, for example, we've seen these things we call dust devils. They're these lovely little Martian mini tornadoes that go whirling across the terrain, and we've taken pictures of those, and we've actually taken multiple pictures and strung them together to make these movies of dust devils dancing around on the plains of Mars. In order to do that, we need to be lucky, because what we do is we just point the camera off in the distance and we just shoot lots of pictures. And then we send those pictures down, and most of the time there's no dust devil there. Occasionally we get lucky. What we've done now is we've taught the rovers how to recognize things like dust devils on their own. So the rover can take the pictures, and if nothing changes, if there's no dust devil dancing through the scene, it doesn't bother to send them down to us. It only sends the pictures in which something is actually changing.
Squires and the other scientists involved in the NASA rover program said the Mars exploration project has gone way beyond the startling discovery there was water on Mars to ask deeper questions about the chemistry of the water that created the geological evidence that's left. But Squires obliged by boiling down the meaning of that stunning fact, so to speak, for the rest of us.
What we have found with these rovers was that in the distant past, I'm talking 3.5, 4 billion years ago, conditions were different. It was warmer, it was wetter, it was more Earth-like, particularly at the landing site of Opportunity. There was a lot of water beneath the surface. It occasionally came to the surface. This is an environment that in some respects would have been suitable for some forms of life. So what it says is, despite the fact that Mars is a very desolate, dry, cold world now, it wasn't always like that. And the fascinating thing is, at the same time, in the very distant past, when Mars was more Earth-like, that's the very same time that life was first coming into being somehow here on this planet. So it raises the question, if it happened here, could it have happened there as well?
At the American Geophysical Union Conference in San Francisco, I'm Catherine Giraudot, PodTech News.
Imagine if you could do hundreds of different biological or chemical tests on a single substance all at the same time. Now, imagine that you could do all of those tests using a laboratory about the size of a dime. That's the promise of the so-called lab on a chip. The idea has been around for decades. Scientists of all stripes have been trying to figure out how to make the lab on a chip idea work. Now, a group at MIT thinks they've made a breakthrough. From Boston, PodTech's Clark Boyd reports.
Martin Bazant teaches applied mathematics at MIT. Like everyone else, he's watched over the years as computer chips have gotten smaller, while at the same time much more powerful. And that, Bazant says, is the inspiration behind the lab on a chip.
People realize that if you can build small structures, you could also miniaturize sort of other areas of science and technology. And in particular, you could maybe take a chemistry or biology laboratory and also put that on a chip. Because the advantage would be that if you have a bunch of small channels and small chambers, each of which maybe could be manipulating a certain fluid and doing a certain biological test, for example, searching for a molecule or a cell or something, then in a small device, you could actually do thousands or maybe even millions of tests at the same time and very quickly in the same way that you would, you know, be able to do a fast computation. And that would be sort of a kind of quantum leap in the way that field operates. You know, if you think right now, if you want to do 1,000 tests, you employ 1,000 people to pour test tube A into test tube B and wait for an hour and you get an answer. Of course, being a bit facetious, but, you know, that's sort of macroscopic, a biological laboratory. And instead, maybe you could just take a small sample and send it into a chamber that has an array of 100 by 100 little spots on the floor of the chamber where each spot can, you know, detect a certain different kind of molecule, let's say. And you would simultaneously been doing, you know, thousands of tests at the same time. And since everything's very small and, you know, hopefully the sort of detection time is short because things are small, you could get the answers maybe quickly as well. And perhaps even in a portable device.
There are huge challenges to doing this. First, there's the biochemistry involved. How do you design microsensors to detect what you're looking for? Second, and this is where Besant comes in, the physics of fluids changes dramatically at such a small scale. How small a scale? We're talking microns, millionths of a meter, one-tenth the size of a droplet of mist. And when you try to pump fluids through these small spaces, they act less like water and more like honey. One way to push fluids through microchannels on a chip is to use powerful pressure-driven pumping systems. You layer channels on top of each other on the chip, and it essentially develops a kind of valving system for the fluid. Martin Besant explains.
To sort of close off a channel or to make it pump in one direction, you have a channel going transverse to it above it with a little membrane in between, such that when you apply pressure in the upper channel, it pushes the membrane down and clamps the sort of primary channel to shut down the flow. Or if you have three of these cross channels in a row and you time them to sort of push down at three different times successively, you can generate a little wave and have a sort of peristaltic pressure-driven pumping in the lower channel. So then you have basically one set of channels, which is your working channels, and then you have another set of channels, which is for valving and flow control. So you can imagine it gets complicated very quickly, but nevertheless, people have built rather complicated pressure-driven fluidic networks of this type. Actually, that kind of technology has a lot of advantages and, in fact, has been demonstrated to be useful in lots of applications, but it's not going to be what you would use for a portable chip, you know, for one thing.
What are some of those applications that it's already been proven useful for?
Well, people have done, you know, single-cell analysis where they've taken a sample that has a lot of cells in it and sort of flow the cells through one channel, do a detection of if you're looking for a certain kind of cell, and separate out the ones that you want to look at more closely, for example.
But there is a desire to make this more portable.
For certain applications. So, I mean, you could imagine, you know, it would be nice to have a lab on a chip to make a detection first. Maybe, I mean, there are different degrees of portability. So you might be satisfied in a doctor's office to have a device which rolls in on some kind of wheels, you know, and maybe is the size of a chair or something and has, you know, a few buttons on it and maybe has a tiny little chip in the middle but has some kind of peripheral, you know, high voltage power source or pressure transducers and attached to it. On the other hand, there are other applications where you want something truly portable. For example, you know, our work is actually supported by the Army, where you know you might want to detect exposure to a chemical or biological attack, for example, in the field, and you don't have time to, you know, take a blood sample, mail it to a lab, get the results back tomorrow. But you need the answers today, and you also need it to be done with a device that essentially weighs nothing, because soldiers already carry up to about 120 pounds is the standard gear, I think, right now in Iraq for our soldiers. And that's, you know, I'm not sure I could carry 120 pounds very far. And if you are carrying that much, you don't really want to add anything. So if there's going to be any new functionality added, you know, you want something very light. So that's another application. But, you know, there are even, you know, especially if you could make portable devices that are use cheap enough technology that they can be disposable, then you get into all the things like, you know, home tests, you know, home pregnancy tests being the most obvious, where you know you don't necessarily need a lab on a chip to do that, but for some devices you may want a lab on a chip. You know, one could imagine even paramedics, first responders, crime scene analysis. There are cases where you just might want a quick answer for a medical or chemical diagnostic test in the field with a handheld device, and you don't want necessarily to go to a lab to get the answer.
But pressure-driven lab-on-a-chip systems have distinct disadvantages, and so Besant and others have been working with something called electroosmotic flows.
If you take a pressure-driven flow, as the channel width gets smaller and smaller, it gets harder and harder to push, because basically there's no slip on the walls, and so you're trying to, there's in some sense like a viscous drag, or like a, think of it as like a friction with the walls, and the smaller they are, the closer you are to those walls that are kind of causing the drag, and it gets very hard to push the fluid through. And effectively, the pressure just becomes enormous that you need to push a fluid through a micron-sized channel or smaller, to the point where you might break apart the channel or, you know, just would take a ridiculous pressure. On the other hand, electric-driven flows are very different. They originate from, specifically I'm talking about electroosmotic flows, actually. And what that means is they're essentially surface-driven flows. So there are flows that occur in an electrolyte, and most liquids we want to work with are electrolytes. So what that means is just simply a solution, typically in water, of ions, which are positively and negatively charged particles. Think of salt. When you dissolve it in water, salt solution is an electrolyte. Your blood is an electrolyte. You know, basically any biological fluid is an electrolyte. And electrolytes, in contact with solid surfaces, form so-called double layer, where there's an excess of one kind of ion versus another. typically for chemical reasons, at the surface, and there's a charge there. And so you can imagine then if you apply a voltage across a channel, or and there's an electric field, it could act on that charge and basically get the fluid moving, effectively causing a slip over the surface. That's the phenomenon of electroosmosis, which was really first described about 100 years ago. Now that we have microfluidics, we can use that same slip. We can actually engineer channels and structures such that when we apply electric fields around them, we generate certain desired flow fields. And so then the challenge becomes, okay, well, how do you actually design a device that takes advantage of electroosmosis? So the standard thing, or the thing that's been, the technique that's been demonstrated, you know, for about at least 15 years, maybe longer, is so-called capillary electroosmosis. That's where you just simply apply an electric field across the entire chip. So you've got some channels, and you have take electrodes which are maybe a centimeter apart on sort of either end of the chip, and you apply 100 to 1,000 volts across the chip, and you generate electric fields that end up being about 100 volts per centimeter, which is kind of what you need. And you generate flows by basically having a slip occur all around the channel and causing sort of a plug-like motion of the fluid in the direction of the field. So you're applying the electric field down the channel.
But that too has disadvantages. You need huge voltages to do it. Soldiers, for example, couldn't carry that kind of power supply with them. So someone came up with the idea of alternating the current across the chip. You bring the electrodes closer together, alternate the current, and you can achieve flows with much less voltage. But that's still too slow for many would-be lab-on-a-chip applications. Bazant drew on the work of groups in France and Spain to offer up a solution. Essentially, he went 3D.
So the idea is that until now, people had basically looked at just planar electrodes. In other words, they've got a flat surface of the channel on the, let's say, the bottom surface, and you've got a planar array of flat electrodes that are across the bottom of the channel. Now, what basically I had suggested was to go into the third dimension and to think about, basically, if you have three-dimensional structures for electrodes, what can you do with them to actually generate faster flows? And it turns out there's a very simple, I mean, seemingly very simple trick to generate much faster flows. And that is that the way this ace electroosmosis works is that on each electrode, you've essentially got slip in both directions, you know, and what happens is you sort of bias the system, this broken symmetry I mentioned, so that one side wins. It's like you've got the surface where you think of sort of slip going forward, back, and the forwards eventually win because there's more of them. Okay, so that's sort of how a typical ace electroosmotic pump works. And the very simple idea that I had was that if you've got two pieces of a surface that are fighting each other with slip, one's pushing one way, one's pushing the other way, then the simple way to really get one side to win is to raise up one side. So take the slip that's pointing, let's say, in the direction you want, take that region of the surface, raise it up a little bit, and it then kind of flows right over the other guy who's pointing the wrong way. And not only that, the guy who's pointing the wrong way, instead of hurting you, like when it's flat, the guy pointing the wrong way is, you know, actually fighting you. If you raise up the forward and recess and lower the reverse pumping flow forms a little roll. It actually wraps around, and so that at the higher level of the forward pumping, it forms sort of like a little roller. And so what the flow structure looks like then is what I call a fluid conveyor belt, is that you basically have this nice steady streaming velocity over the top, and these lowered portions of the electrodes are making sort of these little counter-rotating rolls that act as the rollers of a conveyor belt. And what that means is that, so now for the same voltage, you are generating these two slip velocities that were fighting each other before, which is sort of very inefficient. Through raising up one side, you actually got the two working together now, and it has a tremendous effect. Now we actually can hit sort of millimeters per second flows with just a few volts AC. That's a battery voltage. So we don't have, you know, 1,000-volt power supply sitting around. We can actually drive these things with a battery. And in fact, the power draw of these pumps is actually also very small. It's turns out to be about milliwatts, and so you wouldn't need a large battery. You know, a small battery, possibly even a micro battery integrated on the chip would be good enough. So you might be able to sort of integrate all of your kind of fluidic capability onto the chip in a way that is completely sort of integrated with everything else that's been miniaturized. So you truly could have a completely integrated microfluidic chip.
And that does improve your possibilities of portability.
Well, that's the thing. So it opens up the possibilities of new applications. So, you know, where the real sweet spot is for this technology is, you know, something that I think, you know, time will tell. And we're, you know, certainly trying to address that. But there's no question that the ability to sort of pump fluids, with these kind of velocities, with these kind of voltages, in a way that's fairly simple to microfabricate even, is valuable.
Great, Martin. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks.
The remaining drawback is that, for now, Bezant and his team can't push every kind of fluid through the chip. They can't, for example, push blood through it unless it's been diluted. For most useful tests, that may not matter. But Bezant and his team don't care. They want to improve the chip until it can handle the real deal. In Boston, this is Clark Boyd for Podtech News.
World of Warcraft and Second Life are two of the most popular video games in the world. However, they're not typical of video games. They're played solely online with other players from around the world. They can't be paused, and the game itself can't be beaten. A recent survey suggests those factors and others are why these types of games can cause serious addiction problems for gamers. Rio Pacino has the story.
Massive multiplayer online role-playing games, also known as MMORPGs, are gaining popularity among the gaming community at a rapid pace. Games such as Second Life and Guild Wars have millions of users participate in their virtual worlds. And even Comedy Central's South Park dedicated an entire episode to World of Warcraft, which has 7.5 million subscribers.
So what's the plan?
All right, log in tonight from your computers at precisely 7:30. We will meet here on the plains of the Elwynn Forest near Westfall. My friends, to victory!
To victory!
I don't play World of Warcraft.
Butters, you said you're on your computer all the time.
Yeah, but I'm playing Hello Kitty Island Adventure.
Butters, go buy World of Warcraft, install it on your computer, and join the online sensation before we all murder you.
All right then.
But it may not be all fun and games for the South Park crew and other MMORPG players. A recent survey by Nottingham Trent University in the United Kingdom says these type of games can become dangerously addicting. I spoke with Professor Mark Griffiths, director of Nottingham's International Gaming Unit, about the results of the survey and what forms of addiction are tied to MMORPGs.
We surveyed over 7,000 online gamers, which is probably one of the world's largest studies. And we found that 12% of our sample, which was over 800 people, had at least three signs of addiction, things like players saying they get withdrawal symptoms if they can't play their favorite online games,
right.
Building up tolerance over time, needing to play the games more and more for longer and longer periods. The main one really is being totally preoccupied with the game that they actually play. Although I've been pointing out to people that just because you do something excessively doesn't necessarily make it bad. Really, when we talk about addiction, when the press ring me up and say, well, what's the difference between a healthy excessive enthusiasm and an addiction? And basically, healthy enthusiasms add to life and addictions take away from it.
While conducting this survey, how did you guys determine if a gamer is or is not addicted?
I mean, basically, we used the World Health Organization criteria for what they call psychoactive substance abuse, and we obviously just adapted it. Instead of using the word alcohol or drug, we inserted the word video game in there. And obviously, there might be a false assumption that you can't naturally use something that's been designed specifically for drugs and just apply it to video games. Having said that, I've spent 20 years studying things like gambling addictions and other behavioral addictions. And for me, most of the core components of addiction, things like salience and tolerance and mood modification and relapse and conflict, these come up in all the addiction criteria.
With World of Warcraft, I mean, that's a highly popular game, has 7.5 million subscribers. You could also throw out Second Life or Guild Wars. All those games are very popular MMORPGs. Now, with the rising popularity of these games, do you see gaming addiction becoming a more prevalent problem?
Well, it depends what you mean. I certainly don't think there'll be a massive increase in prevalence of gaming addiction amongst gamers. I mean, overall, as more and more people play, then obviously the overall amount of numbers would probably rise. But again, it's on how you actually define addiction in the first place. And you say you can line up 50 psychologists and we can all give, slightly different definitions of what it is to be addicted. I mean, one of the things, the points I'm trying to make in terms of online gaming addiction, it may well be that if you are somebody who is susceptible or vulnerable to very excessive play, the thing about a lot of the online games that's different from the offline games, of course, is that these games are never-ending. They are 24 hours a day, 365 days of the year.
You think that's what makes it so difficult for MMORPG players to stop playing these games? Because you can't beat the game, there's no ending boss, you can't pause the game. You think that's probably one of the main reasons why it's so difficult for these gamers to stop playing?
Yeah, without a doubt, they are some of the big contributory factors of why it's so hard, if you like, to stop playing any particular point, because it's never-ending and, you know, it's basically infinite in terms of the playing experience. And, of course, there are lots of different rewards that people get when playing games. Again, we've done a lot of work on EverQuest over the last few years, and it's quite obvious that there are gender differences, there are age differences, and, you know, people get different things of different, you know, out of different parts of the game. And it's quite clear that when we talk about addictions or we talk about doing something excessively, what we're talking about is being constantly rewarded for being in that, you know, doing that particular behavior. And, it, you know, what's very obvious to me is that different people get different rewards at different times for doing different things. And that's the great thing about lots of games, whether it's standalone games or it's a, you know, massively multiplayer online game, is that, you know, people get different things out of it. And, you know, that's what makes it so rewarding.
Regular games weren't taken into account in this survey. If that were the case, would the numbers be different?
You know, some of the surveys I've done before still have indicated that a small proportion do seem to show signs of, you know, addictive behavior in terms of total preoccupation and withdrawal symptoms and tolerance. The problem is, of course, is this survey has been a lot, you know, in terms of number of participants, is a lot bigger than we've used before. And the real problem with our survey is we use what was called a self-selected sample. These were questionnaires that went out online, and okay, the great news was that we got over 7,000 people filling out the questionnaires, but what we don't know is to what extent those 7,000 are representative of, you know, all online game players. You could argue that maybe we've underrepresented addiction, because if you're so addicted to the game, you wouldn't have time to fill out our questionnaire. The answer is we just don't know. But it is a big limitation of the study, is that it's not, you know, we're the first to admit it's not a representative study, but because it is such a big sample of players, you know, what we're saying is that, you know, there may be addictive signs for these people, but, you know, I do want to put it into context and say just because there are addictive signs still doesn't necessarily mean it's a full-blown addiction.
Right, I think that's probably the biggest concern with the survey, is determining what is addiction, what is being addicted to a game. I mean, I play video games, people...
Well, if you ask me what it is to be addicted to a game, I would say that if for someone to be addicted to a game is that, let's just say World of Warcraft. For me to be to define you as a World of Warcraft addict, World of Warcraft would have to be the single most important thing in that person's life, something they would do to the neglect of everything else in their life. They would get withdrawal symptoms if they were unable to actually engage in playing World of Warcraft. That over time, what you would see is that maybe they started off playing a few hours a day. Is that when you build up tolerance, you might be playing 10, 11, 12, 13 hours a day and building up the amount of time you have to play. The most important thing in terms of addiction is what we call conflict. This activity would completely conflict with every other activity in your life.
Well, that makes me feel a lot better. I mean, I don't play World of Warcraft, but I do play Final Fantasy online and also play, you know, other games on. I have an Xbox 360, I also have a PS2. And my friends consider me an addictive gamer. But that's that fine line again. What do you consider addiction?
I think the other thing, of course, is that this is very much part of your life as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know people that, you know, I've done a lot of work on internet addiction. You know, and obviously if the internet is a, you know, major part of your life and you use it in terms of the job that you do, there's nothing wrong with that. A lot of these things, if they, you know, serve a very functional use, mm-hmm, in your life, then you know, they wouldn't necessarily be seen as problematic.
Exactly, and this is my job, so...
Yeah, exactly, and there's nothing wrong. And again, even some of my research team, you know, I have to say one of my research team is somebody that plays probably, you know, 3 or 4 hours every single night and has 2 mega long sessions at the weekend. But the point is, it doesn't interfere with his job at all. He's got no partner at the moment, has no children. This is something that, you know, instead of drinking alcohol or abusing drugs or doing other things, it's something that, you know, serves a very functional part of his life, and, you know, there's no negative detrimental effect, so it can't possibly be classed as an addiction in any way, shape, or form.
With the constant release of expansion packs and patches for MMORPGs, it's likely that these games will not become stale for fans of the genre anytime soon. In fact, World of Warcraft is releasing its highly anticipated Burning Crusade patch in January. So it's likely World of Warcraft and other MMORPGs will continue to thrive.
They did it! They killed him!
They did it! They killed him! We can come out!
Yes! Yeah!
We did it, you guys. We're totally heroes.
That was such uber pwnage.
I can't believe it's all over. What do we do now?
What do you mean? Now we can finally play the game.
Oh, yeah. Okay, Kenny, add Eyes of the Beast to your hotbar. Stan, check your fury talents to boost your shouts. Got it?
For PodTech News, I'm Rio Pacino.
And that's PodTech News Weekly Magazine for Saturday, December 16th, 2006. For Jason Lopez, I'm Paul Landcourt.